Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode. Welcome to the Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. In this week's podcast, Eric Compton finds opportunities within bank dividends in today's market. Alex Bryan offers ideas for a range of ETFs on the ESG spectrum. Christine Benz takes a second look at what experts predicted for long-term returns of stocks and bonds. Illinois State Treasurer Mike Frerichs shares how the Treasury Office helps investors. Greg Warren shares his thoughts on how Berkshire will be affected by the pandemic. And Christine Benz discusses how a downturn is not a buying opportunity for every investor. Let's get started. Here's Eric Compton from Morningstar Research Services.
Today, bank valuations are about as cheap as they have been since 2008. With lower valuations come higher dividend yields, but also more implicit risk, which begs the question, are bank dividend yields worth it today? The current situation is unprecedented in many ways. We've never really been in an environment where we have willingly shut down 30% of the economy, where GDP could drop as fast as the current estimates suggest, and where unemployment has spiked so high, so fast. Today's debate is not about earnings per share. It is about the capital adequacy and the solvency of the U.S. financial system. While there are many unknowns and the risks are real, we believe the banks are ready for almost any hit to capital. Our base case is that the U.S. economy and financial system will eventually emerge intact after COVID-19. As such, we think it is appropriate to view the banks as undervalued, and we believe there are opportunities within bank dividends today. Our current top dividend pick among the money center banks is Wells Fargo. The bank has a dividend yield of over 7%, which suggests higher risks, but the bank has one of the more conservative underwriting cultures under our coverage. The bank typically does better than peers on stress tests and has the lowest capital requirements among the G-SIBs and also the most excess capital. As such, we think the dividend is currently safe for Wells, even though its dividend yield is materially higher than peers. Our top pick among the regionals is Truist Financial. While the bank's dividend yield of roughly 5% isn't the highest under our coverage, we calculate that the dividend should be safe. The bank has a strong earnings stream to help support the dividend, and if you include the unamortized loan marks on the bank's loan book, a result of the recent merger between BB&T and SunTrust, Truist has the largest reserve coverage among the banks we cover, as compared to the most recently available stress test data. As such, we believe the bank should be able to sustain its dividend through the current downturn.
6 days a week, we deliver the latest news for investors. Just say, Alexa, enable the Morningstar skill, or visit morningstar.com/Alexa. Now, Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance for Morningstar Inc., and Alex Bryan from Morningstar Research Services.
Hi, I'm Christine Benz from Morningstar.com. The universe of exchange-traded funds that focus on ESG, or environmental social governance issues, is rapidly expanding. Joining me to discuss some of the key ETF types currently available is Alex Bryan. He's Morningstar's Director of Passive Strategies Research in North America for Morningstar Research Services. Alex, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the specifics of various ETFs pursuing ESG strategies, let's look at how Morningstar approaches rating ESG funds. So the analyst ratings don't attempt to evaluate how funds are doing in terms of their ESG factors, do they?
That's correct. So we treat our Morningstar analyst ratings for ESG funds the same that we do any other fund, which is based on our forward-looking assessment of how well that fund is going to do in terms of risk and return relative to its category peers. So we're not making a subjective assessment of whether or not we think the fund is delivering on its ESG mandate. For that, the Morningstar sustainability rating, which is powered by data from Sustainalytics, that might be more relevant to try to gauge that. But the analyst ratings are really strictly focusing on risk and return on a go-forward basis.
Okay. So historically, one of the biggest knocks against ESG investing is that these strategies were often more costly than non-ESG strategies. With the strong uptake and entrance of ETFs and index funds focusing on ESG matters, is that changing?
It is. You know, historically, a lot of ESG index funds were quite a bit more expensive than the lowest cost non-ESG focused index funds. Today, there are a lot of low cost ESG options. Some charge as low as 10 basis points. That's still a little bit more than the lowest cost passive funds out there, but it's pretty close. And I think fees always matter, but there's an ever expanding menu of low cost ESG options. So I don't think cost is really a big hurdle anymore for investors who care about some of these social issues.
Okay. So you focus the upcoming issue of Morningstar ETF Investor on the ESG universe, and you say that it really runs the gamut. So let's take a spin through some of these different ETF types that are available, starting with kind of the original ESG strategies, which were very much about excluding companies in objectionable industries. So what's an example of an ESG ETF with sort of that old school type of exclusionary strategy?
I think Vanguard ESG US stock ETF is a really good example of this type of fund, which is what I consider to be kind of a values-based exclusion approach to investing. So this fund tries to provide very broad exposure to the US stock market, but it excludes stocks that are involved in certain lines of businesses that some investors might find controversial. So for example, this fund excludes all firms that derive a large part of their revenue from the sale of fossil fuels. It avoids companies involved in the production and distribution of alcohol, firearms, gambling, tobacco, things like that. But the active share of this fund is actually quite low. So it's actually providing very broad exposure to the market, covering between 70 to 80% of the US market. But it does exclude some of those types of companies that some investors might find objectionable. As a result of those exclusions, what you end up getting is a fund that has some modest sector tilts relative to the broad market. So this tends to be underweight energy, overweight technology, as you might expect. But it's really designed to try to effectively diversify risk while avoiding some of those controversial businesses that some investors might find objectionable.
ESG offerings have increasingly evolved beyond just excluding companies and instead use positive screens to identify companies that are managing ESG risks. So what's an example of a fund with a strategy along those lines?
iShares ESG MSCI USA Leaders ETF, I think, is a really good example of this type of fund that's looking beyond just excluding certain types of businesses to look for firms that are exemplary in terms of how they deal with their ESG risk and opportunities that are relevant for their particular industries. So this particular fund targets stocks that are really leaders in their industry. It's looking for firms that are taking steps to mitigate the risk that might be most relevant to them. So for example, within the banking sector, it might look for stocks that are taking steps to manage data security and doing a really good job of that. Within the consumer products industries, it might be looking at how firms are packaging their goods to make sure that they're doing that in a sustainable way. So the characteristics that it's looking for are really industry relative, and they're most relevant for each industry. But I think this is a really good example of a fund that's really going after those leaders. It ends up taking a bit more active risk than that Vanguard fund because it's setting a higher bar for inclusion. But if you are someone who does care about these issues, I think this is a really good strategy that tries to put ESG first ahead of mitigating tracking error.
You mentioned active risk, Alex. Let's talk about what that is. And can you give us an example of a fund that does try to control for that active risk while pursuing an ESG strategy?
Yeah, so active risk is really any bet that you're making relative to the market. And the types of active risk that you need to be concerned about are the types of risk that you may not necessarily target or that you don't necessarily want. So if you're an ESG-focused investor, clearly you want to own firms that are managing their ESG risk better than others. But sometimes along with those ESG screens, you end up getting these ancillary bets. So for example, a lot of ESG funds tend to be structurally underweight energy stocks, and they tend to be structurally overweight technology stocks. And that can be a source of risk that can, sometimes it pays off and helps your performance. Sometimes it may actually hurt your performance. And so there's really this trade-off between mitigating active risk and really owning the very best ESG firms out there. The more you reach for ESG leaders, the more your risk of underperforming the market might be, or outperforming the market. You definitely have a greater risk of having a performance stream that looks quite different from the market. And so there's some ESG-minded funds out there that try to balance ESG against mitigating tracking error to the broader market. So effectively helping you target the type of risk that you want, which is exposure to ESG leaders, while still maintaining broad diversification so that you're not really banking on a few individual companies or a few individual sectors. So a fund that I think strikes this balance quite well is the iShares ESG MSCI USA ETF. It's a mouthful, but this fund basically measures ESG leaders in the same way that the Sustainal ETF does. The only difference here is that this actively tries to mitigate tracking error to the broader market. So it's effectively constraining the portfolio to keep the sector weightings in line, to keep the risk in line with the broader market. So if you're looking to have something that could serve as a core fund, but still lean into some of the ESG leaders in the market, I think this is a really good option. Okay.
Finally, let's take a look at an ETF that takes a more proactive approach to ESG issues.
So I think iShares Global Impact ETF is a really good option for investors that want to do more than just own firms that are managing their social practices in a favorable way, looking for firms that are actually producing goods and services designed to address one of the world's major social or environmental challenges like hunger, education, clean water, global healthcare. This is a bit more of a compact portfolio that invests in firms like Tesla, a lot of healthcare companies like Johnson & Johnson. It may be more appealing for investors that are looking to invest in companies that are changing the world for the better.
Alex, it's always great to get your perspective. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for watching. I'm Christine Benz for Morningstar.com.
Watch all the Morningstar content you love from your living room. Download the Morningstar Roku channel and get up-to-date independent insights on today's markets. Be comfortable. Be informed.
Next up, Susan Jabinski and Christine Benz from Morningstar, Inc.
Hi, I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar.com. What does the recent market volatility mean for the long-term returns of stocks and bonds? Here with me to share what she's been hearing from some investment firms is Christine Benz. Christine's is Morningstar's Director of Personal Finance. Christine, thanks for joining us today.
Susan, it's great to be here.
Now, every year you take a look at what some of the major investment firms, including Morningstar, is expecting in terms of long-term stock and bond market returns. And why do firms go out and make these forecasts every year?
Well, a couple of key reasons. One is that they are oftentimes managing portfolios themselves. So whether they're using strategic asset allocation strategies or ones that are more tactical, they do have to have some sort of view on the returns for various asset classes. So that's a key reason. And then another reason is that many of these firms are providing guidance to financial advisors, individual investors, who in turn might use some of these forecasts to guide their plans.
So how do you recommend that individual investors use these forecasts?
Well, you definitely don't want to use any sort of tactical strategy, because one thing we see is that even professional tactical asset allocators have a really difficult time making that work. But I do think that you need some sort of return assumption if you're doing financial planning. So if you know roughly what your portfolio will return, that in turn can tell you how much you need to save, or if you're in drawdown mode in retirement, can help you figure out how much you can safely withdraw. So you do need some sort of return assumptions to do very basic financial planning. You need to plug something in. And then another reason why I often like to look at these forecasts is just because I think they provide an additional impetus to do something that's really good for our portfolios, which is to periodically rebalance. So if you're looking at these forecasts, you might see that the asset class you probably should be lightening up on may have fairly muted returns going forward, whereas the one that has more robust looking returns is probably the one that you would want to be adding to. So it just provides an impetus to do good portfolio hygiene.
Now, you've been gathering these forecasts from asset managers for the past several years, and you present them to our readers in an article usually in January. So given that you did do that very thing this past January, what sort of made you want to go back and see if these firms had made any changes?
Well, we really had a feeling that things had probably changed because of the extreme market volatility that we have experienced due to this pandemic. So, of course, we had the big equity market shock, which potentially depressed valuations, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And we also have seen high-quality bond yields drop significantly. So those two factors made us want to check up on whether there were changes, and indeed there have been.
So let's start with U.S. equities. What sort of impact has the market volatility and the pandemic had on the forecasts there?
There's a comforting consistency, actually, when you look across forecasts from various firms. And I don't think it's sort of a me too sort of thing. I think that truly there is the view that because we have seen such volatility, even with recessionary fears on the horizon or potentially here already, there's a sense that valuations, depressed valuations today, should lead to better equity market returns than was the expectation coming into this year. And that was true across all of the firms I looked at. But I would say, Susan, that no one should get too excited about the expectations for U.S. equity market returns. Across all of these firms, the expectation was generally sort of like low to mid single digits for U.S. equities. And some of these firms have an expectation that inflation could come back, which will gobble up some of that return as well. So better looking return forecasts for U.S. stocks, but by no means exciting.
And what we had seen in these expert forecasts during the past couple of years was that a lot of these firms were expecting foreign stocks, foreign equities to outperform U.S. stocks. Is that still the thinking? Has that shifted at all?
It's still very much the case. So I would say, you know, I was talking earlier about the value of rebalancing, and I would say for equity investors, based on these forecasts, that looks like something to consider because across the board, the return prospects for foreign stocks from these firms was higher than was the case for U.S. So in most cases, they were in mid to high single digits for developed markets, foreign stocks. Some firms are much more optimistic about the returns for emerging markets equities. So investors who want to make a play on that sector or potentially buy some sort of a fund that has encompassing developed and emerging markets exposure, to me, that seems probably like a smart thing to do.
Now, let's pivot over to bonds and what sort of changes there might be in the forecasts there.
Really, it's pretty bifurcated. So one thing we saw in the first quarter was great strength with high quality bonds, and we've seen yields come way, way down. And that in turn has prompted most of these firms to really pull in their expectations for high quality bond returns for the next decade. On the other hand, we have seen spreads widen, credit spreads, yield spreads widen. And so most firms do have higher return expectations for even high quality corporate bonds, but certainly lower quality corporates as well. Those will obviously be accompanied by higher volatility, but it does seem like if you're willing to own a little bit of corporate bond exposure, maybe a dash of lower quality bond exposure, you can accentuate your return a little bit as well, albeit with a little more volatility.
Christine, thank you so much for these updates today. This is great for perspective as we're evaluating our portfolios.
Thank you, Susan.
I'm Susan Jabinski for Morningstar. Thank you for tuning in.
Now, Karen Wallace of Morningstar Inc. and Illinois State Treasurer Mike Frericks.
For Morningstar, I'm Karen Wallace. We're fortunate to be joined today by Mike Frericks, the State Treasurer of Illinois. Treasurer Frericks is also the chair of the College Savings Plan Network, as well as an active member of the National Association of State Treasurers. And today he's going to discuss some of the ways state treasurers are helping people weather the COVID-19 uncertainty. Treasurer Frericks, thanks so much for being here. I hope you're doing well during these unusual times.
Karen, good to be with you. Unusual they are. I am balancing my roles as state treasurer with at-home tutor, all from the home office here in Champaign, Illinois.
Please tell us a little bit about what you do as state treasurer. What is it that your office is responsible for?
Yeah, I guess that's a good question. I'm the state's chief investment and banking officer. We're in charge of managing the state's money, investing it. We do that on a state portfolio of about $13 billion. We help local municipalities and units of government manage their money to the tune of about $6 billion. And then we also help give people the tools they need to invest in themselves, whether that be college savings, retirement savings, or savings for people with disabilities. We have about another $13 to $14 billion there.
And I wonder if we can shift gears a little bit here. You're also the chair of the College Savings Plan Network. I wonder if we could discuss some of the issues that you and CSPN are currently addressing. And specifically, I hoped you could weigh in on a reader question we received from somebody wondering sort of how to handle a college tuition refund if the expenses were paid for with a 529 withdrawal.
There are three things I would say. One, CSPN members are supporting each other. At the outset of this crisis, I encourage all CSPN members to work together, to share their stories, and collaborate on how best to operate, market, and communicate in these rapidly changing times. So through CSPN meetings and webinars, 529 plans across the country are learning from one another and helping each other understand the moment we're in and how we might best serve 529 plan investors. CSPN is providing its members and the public with guidance on recent market volatility. So CSPN recently released guidance for 529 investors under the title, Should I Continue to Save in a 529 Plan During the COVID-19 Market Turmoil? We think the answer is yes. CSPN recommends that investors keep in perspective that college savings goals are long-term. Staying the course is an essential part of keeping those dreams moving forward. And when considering an investment change or withdrawal, remember that liquidating assets or switching investment may lock in losses if markets rebound. We suggest they adopt a do-what-you-can mantra for college savings. If folks are unable to contribute as they did before, that's okay. However, if possible, even setting aside $5 or $10 a week can add up over time. No one can guarantee what the market will look like tomorrow. Keeping the future in mind is important, just as it is with retirement. I think also CSPN is serving as a bridge between Washington, D.C. and the nation's 529 plans. We're helping 529 plans understand the SECURE Act, CARES Act, and other federal legislation. For example, CSPN is working with Treasury to clarify the tax treatment of student loan payments for a beneficiary's sibling. 529 plans need to clarify to whom the 1099-Q form will be issued. NAST and CSPN very recently worked to communicate temporary rules changes for refunds. So I think this might be helpful to your caller or person who wrote in.
Right.
Typically, if an account owner receives a refund from a college, the refund must be redeposited into the 529 account within 60 days to not be treated as a non-qualified withdrawal. Treasury recently gave account owners until July 15th to deposit their refunds into their 529. And the College Savings Plan Network is helping 529 plans understand this rule change and communicate it to account holders.
Let's discuss some of the other programs and resources that are sort of available through your office that can help people. You mentioned college savings. What are some other sort of programs through the state that the state treasurer offers?
Charitable trust is another program we have. We've decided to give organizations more time to apply for grants. We have about $375,000 available for the spring cycle through the charitable trust stabilization, given the impact of COVID-19. We've extended the application deadline until April 30th for nonprofits to submit their paperwork. We also find ourselves in the middle of Financial Literacy Month. While Illinoisans are under shelter in place due to the COVID-19 pandemic, we've launched the Financial Literacy Month resources page at our website. During these times of e-learning, which we're all, well, those with kids are very much aware of, my team and I want to make sure that teachers, children, young adults, parents, seniors, and all families in Illinois have free access to a wide variety of financial education resources and programs. Tools and resources are offered around topics including money-minded curriculum, student loans, saving for college, mortgage issues, debt, avoiding fraud and reporting scams, and retirement savings planning.
You're an active member of the National Association of State Treasurers. What are some other ways that state treasurers are reacting to COVID-19, and what resources related to the CARES Act are available to people across the country?
Great. I know not all of your listeners will be in Illinois, but it's nice to know that NAST, the National Association of State Treasurers, is helping the members navigate this crisis and continue to gather and host resources around NAST advocacy, legislative updates related to COVID-19, and guidance on relief funding and aids. State treasurers have been working closely with their federal, state, and local partners to ensure the critical business and investment functions while providing relief programs and financial education resources toward American families and workers. We have links that we have available from California, Massachusetts, Utah that can provide an example. Our California state treasurer has some resources out there. I think most treasurers have something, but we've also come together in terms of advocacy. On April 19th, or April 14th, I think it was, I joined four state treasurers: Pennsylvania Treasurer Joe Torsella, Delaware's Treasurer Colleen Davis, Rhode Island Treasurer Seth Magaziner, and Colorado Treasurer Dave Young, to call on manufacturers of ventilators to release service manuals to repair ventilators for the duration of the coronavirus pandemic. Without this critically important information, hospitals are unable to make repairs to ventilators, rendering them unable or unusable during a time of dire need.
Treasurer Frerichs, thanks so much for being here and taking the time to answer our questions. We really appreciate your insights.
Great. Karen, thank you very much.
For Morningstar, I'm Karen Wallace.
Expand your investing horizons and look to the long view with Morningstar's new podcast, The Long View. Join hosts Christine Benz and Jeff Patak as they talk to influential leaders in investing, advice, and personal finance. Search for and subscribe to The Long View today. Next, Susan Jabinski from Morningstar Inc. talks with Greg Warren from Morningstar Research Services.
Hi, I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar.com. Berkshire Hathaway is holding its annual meeting on Saturday for the first time, virtually only. Here today with me to discuss Berkshire's valuation is Greg Warren. Greg is a senior analyst with Morningstar, and he covers Berkshire Hathaway for us. Now, one question on the minds of investors is what impact the COVID-19 pandemic is having on Berkshire and its businesses. Can you comment a little bit about that?
Well, you know, it's kind of difficult with Berkshire to know with full precision what kind of the impact is going to be, because the company is not really the most transparent of firms when it comes to its operating subsidiaries. So when we've been looking at building assumptions in our modeling, you know, for example, like a 25% decline in the value of the stock investment portfolio, We're trying to make sure we're being very conservative with our approach to valuation, you know, especially driven by all these uncertainties that have been created by the pandemic. Our current thinking right now is the company is going to be impacted by three different ways related to the pandemic. One, historically low interest rates, with the Fed cutting rates down to near zero. This opens up refinancing funding opportunities for many of Berkshire's operating subsidiaries, as well as the parent company, but should also lead to lower yields on cash and cash equivalents holdings, which were around $128 billion at the end of 2019. We're also expecting to see more volatile equity and credit markets, which will not only impact the large equity investment portfolio on the books of the insurance operations, but should provide some opportunities for the firm to put more capital to work in the near term. And then the third wave is going to be the U.S. and global recession. You know, the question here is how deep and how long will the recession run? Just sort of, you know, back of the envelope, look at the firm, you're going to have some impact on the railroad business. You know, they do a lot of stuff intermodal from the West Coast ports. a lot of shipping, agriculture, coal, other products, you know, within the country. And we feel like BNSF is a little bit more at risk relative to its peers because, you know, even though it's been beating, say, Union Pacific, its closest competitor on a volume and a revenue basis the past 5 years, it's been trailing it on an operating profitability perspective. And as we go through this crisis and sort of economic downturn, our concern is that its peers might get more price competitive with BNSF, putting them at a bit of a disadvantage. But when we think about sort of the recession impacts on the insurance business, tends to be a little bit more recession resistant than most. Same with the utilities. The manufacturing service and retailing operations is really where the bulk of the impact might be. As a result, we've pulled back on expectations for revenue growth and profitability for pretty much every business within there. Expectations are there might be a couple businesses within that business that go under. And that's something that, you know, was confirmed by Charlie Munger last week when he talked to the Wall Street Journal.
Now, we continue to assign Berkshire a wide economic moat rating. How stable are Berkshire's competitive advantages, given what's been going on in the market and the economy and what we're expecting going forward?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at competitive advantages, especially if they're solid competitive advantages like Berkshire has in a lot of their businesses, those tend to remain in place during economic downturns. And it may actually even strengthen depending on the positioning of the company relative to its peers. In Berkshire's case, there are operations that will remain stable, like I was saying, insurance, primarily because the firm has always been a disciplined underwriter in that business. And the issues that are likely to impact the firm, both from a claims and a loss perspective, are probably going to be affecting the industry as a whole. I mean, when we think about stuff like pandemic insurance or business disruption insurance, a lot of that tends to get syndicated, which means it gets spread out across the industry as a whole. So it's not like Berkshire's the only one that's going to be feeling losses. Pretty much across the board, their peers are. The question will be how much pricing hardens once we get out of this and who takes pricing and who doesn't. And that's where the competition sort of works in when we get through that. And then, you know, when we think about the railroad, I was just mentioning the fact that, you know, I feel like they're at a slight disadvantage on an operating profitability perspective. And I'll have a close eye on them as we get through this to make sure that they're maintaining at least a decent positioning. Part of that comes with the fact that most of the industry's adopted precision scheduled railroading, which has driven down costs within those companies. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. And then, you know, what I was saying with the manufacturing service and retailing businesses, we don't expect much to change from a competitive positioning perspective, but we do, and we have thought this historically. Our thesis on this part of the business has always been there's likely to be one or two or three businesses where their competitive advantage diminishes over time or they eventually go out of business, but it's not big enough to really sort of drag down results for the overall operations.
Lastly, has the pandemic had any impact on our valuation of Berkshire Hathaway? And do we think that the stock is undervalued, fairly valued, or overvalued today?
You know, we actually took the fair value down about 10% earlier this month after incorporating a lot of different assumptions, like, you know, the aforementioned 25% decline in the value of the stock investment portfolio into our valuation model. The key here is as we get more clarity in the impact of the pandemic is likely to have in different aspects of the business. You know, through the filings of competitors as well as the firm itself, we expect to be updating our assumptions and perhaps might update our fair value estimate. That said, we've always traditionally stuck with a very conservative bent when we value Berkshire. You know, given that the sum of the parts methodology we use to value the firm requires us stripping the company completely apart, valuing the different pieces, and then sticking it all back together again. So, you know, you're sort of margin of error increases the more you mess around with stuff and have, you know, a greater number of assumptions built into your modeling. So we try to stay as conservative as possible. So we're comfortable where we are right now. But like we said, you know, as information comes in, as we get better details on what the impact could be on, say, insurance claims or what the impact is on the manufacturing businesses and whatnot, you know, we will make adjustments to the model, and that may impact the fair value as we move forward. As far as the valuation goes right now, the company is trading at around a 15-20% discount to our fair value estimate. You know, if we look at it on a price-to-book basis, the shares are trading about 1.2 times our estimate for first quarter 2020 book value and then 1.2 times end of 2020 2020 and 1.1 times end of 2021. Relatively cheap when we look at it compared to historical values. And if you go back over the past 5-10 calendar years, Berkshire's generally traded around 1.4 to 1.5 times book value per share. So if we look at it both on a price to fair value and a price to book value basis, the company's relatively cheap compared to past cycles.
Greg, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
For Morningstar.com, I'm Susan Jabinski. Thank you for tuning in.
And lastly, Susan Jabinski and Christine Benz from Morningstar, Inc.
Hi, I'm Susan Jabinski with Morningstar.com. Investors often hear that periods of market volatility provide them with an opportunity to buy. However, whether you should be buying or not depends on a lot of different factors, including your life stage and what type of investor you are. Here with me to discuss if you are inclined to buy and if you are the right investor to do that is Christine Benz. Christine is Morningstar's Director of Personal Finance. Christine, thank you for joining us today.
Susan, it's great to be here.
Now, let's start with a really general question. You know, is really a downturn a buying opportunity for all investors?
Well, no. And this is one of my pet peeves. You sometimes hear people say, no one should sell anything when the market goes down. And my view has been actually for people who are getting close to retirement, many of them had been reticent to de-risk their portfolios during the long-running bull market that we have enjoyed for most of the past decade. Some investors should still actually be thinking about lightening up on stocks. You probably don't want to be doing that in the depths of a market panic, but I think you do want to take a step back and take a look at your asset allocation and see what sorts of changes might be in order. Some investors are probably underweight the safe stuff relative to their proximity to needing to spend their money.
Now, there's a difference between how a hands-on investor might approach market volatility and taking opportunity there versus a hands-off investor and how he or she might take advantage of that. So let's start with the hands-off investor. What are some ideas or things a hands-off investor could be doing right now or thinking about?
I love hands-off investors because in my experience, they often do just as well as investors who are more hands-on. So a couple of ideas would be to think about getting some professional guidance. I think junctures like this where you do see a lot of market volatility might spook people who were otherwise feeling confident in their ability. So either pay a financial advisor to look at the totality of your plan. That can be money well spent. On the other hand, you might look at some sort of DIY solutions. So you might look at a target date fund or a balanced fund. And the nice thing with solutions like that or hiring an advisor is that you're delegating the decision about what you should be doing to a professional. And the nice thing about some of these products that do it for you is that in periods of market volatility, they're rebalancing into the weakness. So even though you might not feel like buying stocks, they're stepping up and buying stocks for you. So we see that investors in these all-in-one type funds tend to do really well on a dollar-weighted return basis, meaning that they just add to their funds over time, and that nets out to be a pretty good take-home return. You might also think about upping your allocations, so increasing your contributions to your 401k plan or to your IRAs. Down markets are a great time to think about increasing contributions. You might also think about taking advantage of a solution that's built into a lot of 401k plans these days, which is an automatic rebalancing feature. So if you haven't chosen the target date fund in the plan, or if you haven't chosen a managed account or something like that, the auto rebalancing actually takes care of that rebalancing process for you. So those are some really neat solutions that hands-off investors can look to today.
And if hands-off investors are trying to, you know, make some decisions here, do you have any resources that you'd recommend that they consult?
A few that I like. One would be Morningstar's Instant X-ray tool that looks at your portfolio's current asset allocation. Then you can compare that to some kind of a benchmark to see if you're in the right ballpark. A resource for doing that would be Morningstar's lifetime allocation indexes or you could look to Morningstar's target date series report that's on the website that shows asset allocation mixes for various target date series. My model portfolios, I think, are also a decent starting point for people who want to set an asset allocation and not spend a lot of time hovering over it over time. So we've got lots of different portfolios for people at different life stages. Those would be all good starting points for hands-off type investors.
So let's shift over now and to talk about the more hands-on type investor. And here, maybe you want to start by talking about some traps to avoid for those investors who tend to be a little more hands-on.
One, I would say, Susan, is just resist the urge to engage in sort of all or nothing investing. So perhaps investors might be inclined to retreat to cash until this whole pandemic thing clears up. The problem is that tactical asset allocation is very difficult to pull off. By the time investors do start gaining comfort and getting back into stocks, the good news may have already been priced in. So I think you want to be careful with sort of all or nothing asset allocation scenarios. I think it's also wise to resist the urge to make a play on very narrowly focused parts of the market. So you and I have talked about how we've seen energy stocks really hard hit, financial stocks, rather than back up the truck for maybe a sector specific fund focusing on those very hard hit areas. Why not just think about having good value exposure in your portfolio? If you have a broad-based value fund, your manager can do some selective buying perhaps in those sectors, but they're not going to necessarily have the whole portfolio in those hard-hit sectors. So I think that you want to resist the urge to be really narrow with your investments. We tend to see investors undermine their results with some of those narrowly focused funds.
So if that's, you know, some of the things that the hands-on investor should avoid, what are some things that the hands-on investor could or should be doing?
Well, again, I think rebalancing is important. So take a look at your portfolio's current asset allocation relative to your targets. If you don't have a target for your asset allocation, it's a good time to get one. So start there with asset allocation, because ultimately that will be the biggest determinant of how your portfolio behaves. Stepping up contributions is also a great idea for hands-on investors. And then I think they can take advantage of a lot of the resources that we have on Morningstar.com to help really pick their spots. So we have certainly a lot of great articles on the site throughout the week, but we also have our analysts doing the bottom-up work on individual equities as well as funds and ETFs. So rolling up your sleeves, reading those analyst reports. I know our analysts have been very active in terms of reviewing funds, reviewing stocks, engaging with fund managers. And so you can pick up on a lot of that intelligence just by reading the reports.
And then any particular perhaps tools or other specific pieces of content you'd recommend for people to look at?
A few that I like, Susan. One is our price to fair value graph, which is available on the markets tab of Morningstar.com. So you can see whether the stocks in Morningstar's coverage universe in aggregate are trading cheaply or expensively. Right now, prices are a little bit depressed, and you can drill in and see which sectors look relatively more or less attractive through this turbulence. So that's been one of my go-to tools for years. I also like the premium screening tools, where you can screen for companies that have four or five stars, wide moats, whatever other features you like to look at. And then I think another piece of intelligence for hands-on investors would be this compendium of market forecasts that we periodically put out. And that details what firms, both inside Morningstar, our investment management team at Morningstar, as well as external firms, are thinking about in terms of market returns over the next, say, 7 to 10 years. That's another way to think about kind of how you might be positioning your portfolio at this point in time.
Well, Christine, thank you so much. It's terrific food for thought. And we all have a little bit of portfolio examination that we can now do, whether we're hands-on or hands-off.
Thank you, Susan.
I'm Susan Jabinski from Morningstar.com. Thanks for tuning in.
That does it for this week's Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. We hope you have enjoyed our program and we welcome your feedback. Please send your comments and questions to podcasts@morningstar.com. From everyone here at Morningstar, thanks for listening. This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. The podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered tax advice. Please consult a tax and/or financial professional for advice specific to your individual circumstances. Morningstar Research Services, LLC is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analysis, or opinions or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.